Hey everyone, before we get started, I have an announcement to make. Our third annual Design Biz Retreat is coming to Orange County, California, October 20th through the 21st. Join us this fall for a two-day gathering of design visionaries and industry experts where we'll demonstrate the true meaning of community and how it's redefining the way interior design professionals are building stronger and more profitable businesses. This year, we'll feature presentations on selling luxury, the client experience, generating referrals, partnering with custom home builders, and the state of the luxury market. Registration opens June 1st, so mark your calendar because there are only 24 seats available for this exclusive learning opportunity. Now on with the show. Welcome to Design Biz Survival Guide, a podcast about life and business for interior design professionals. My name is Rick Campos, and this podcast is my response to a design community eager to support, share, and inspire one another. We all know that some things simply cannot be taught in a classroom. I believe that our number one resource for information and inspiration is our peers. Join me as I sit down with industry professionals from across the country to discuss their secret to survival in the business of design. Before we get started, we'd like to acknowledge our sponsors who help keep the information and inspiration coming week after week. This podcast episode is sponsored by Perch, the design community's premier resource for appliances, decorative plumbing, and outdoor brands. Perch is dedicated to quality, service, and a heightened showroom experience, making them the preferred choice among architects, builders, and designers just like you. With locations in Los Angeles, Orange County, Palm Springs, and San Diego, their interactive showroom experience must be seen to believe. Fully functional displays and a demo kitchen featuring the industry's top brands provides the ultimate test drive for design enthusiasts. I'm especially excited to announce the opening of their newest showroom in Mission Viejo and the upcoming grand opening of their showroom in the Laguna Design Center. As a trade professional, you're eligible for their exclusive rewards program, Perch Premier, where you'll earn credits for every purchase of appliances, plumbing, hardware, and outdoor kitchens. This program is loaded with perks and benefits, so sign up today and tell them you heard about Perch Premier on Design Biz Survival Guide. Today, we welcome Julie Kacharian, owner and founder of Catch Design Collective, based in Costa Mesa, California. In this episode, we discuss biophilia, the human inclination to connect with nature, and how it influences our design decisions as well as our clients' response to the built environment. Julie shares how so many of our design decisions, like material selections, room layouts, and furniture placement, actually stem from the tenets associated with biophilia. We also discuss how this underlying knowledge acts as a tool to help her intentionally market her business, target better clients, and communicate her design decisions with confidence and conviction. So Julie, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. I am excited to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is going to be fun. Before we dig into all the good stuff, I always like for my guests to introduce themselves so you can tell us what you want us to know about you. So just tell us a little bit about yourself and then we'll dig into the business stuff.
Okay, so my name is Julie Kacharian. I am the owner and founder of Catch Design Collective. We're based in Costa Mesa. I'm originally from actually LA, then moved to New York, and then moved back to Orange County, kind of kicking and screaming, but then now I love living here. I am married. I have two children and a dog. And I've had my business now for about 4 years. Originally, I thought I would join a large firm, but I started right out of school, which I was told it was a big mistake, and it was very scary. But I started very small. I took small projects on and then grew and grew. And now it's myself. I'm the lead designer, and I have two design assistants that support us. So we're a very intimate team, mm-hmm. which is the way I like it, because I don't know, maybe I'm too controlling, but I like to know what's going on in the design, and giving that up was too hard. So we've grown, but I think we'll always stay really small.
That seems to be a trend. It's either a few or a few dozen.
Right.
There's not a whole lot in between.
Yes. And I know other designers who have large staff, and I'm just so impressed that they can manage it all. So again, I'm probably just too anal and too much of a perfectionist and greedy about giving things away too much.
It's a lot. It's a lot. Listen, hey, I get it. I'm a one-man show and I like it that way.
Yes, yes.
So I'm a team player, but I don't know. I like to have my finger on the pulse of everything that's happening. So
I feel the same way.
I get it. I don't understand how some of these designers run such big teams. Well, I do understand how they do it, is they trust the people around them to help them manage that process. But
I probably need to be better at doing that. And I think that's a part of growing from a one woman show to having people who work for you. You have to learn that part of it.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure. You're part of ASID as well, right?
Yes, I am. This year was actually my first year really getting involved with ASID. And if you're a designer, I highly recommend it. I've gone to so many meetings where I've learned so much, have found valuable resources that I needed that, you know, it's hard. You don't want to just Google someone and find them. But if you go to a meeting and you know all the designers are using this one, you know, guy who seals carpet, you're going to trust that person more. So, Right. Yes. So it's a great organization for designers. We have a great local chapter. Highly recommend you guys check it out.
I'm big on networking, so I had to bring that up.
Yes.
It's important. It's super valuable. It's allowed us to interact way more than we probably ever would have just by seeing each other out and about.
Yes. And I did your, I forgot what you called it, but your seminar that you did.
Yeah.
And I found out about that through someone in ASID who told me about it. And I was like, I want to do that. You're doing that. And it was so valuable.
That's right. Yes. It was our retreat last year in Palm Springs.
Yes, the retreat. Exactly.
Yeah. It's a good time. We're coming back this year. We'll be in Orange County this year.
Oh, I will be there.
So tell us a little bit about your education, because that's going to have a lot to do with our conversation here in a minute, because clearly that influences so much of, you know, how you design, and we'll get into that in a minute. But tell us kind of how your education lines up.
Yeah, so I'm a little bit of an overachiever when it comes to education, because I'm kind of like a lifelong learner. I love learning things. So I started my career in the sciences. So I actually, as an undergraduate, I studied life sciences or biology. And then once I was done with that, I got my master's in public health. And once I realized that I wanted to be a designer after spending all of that money on school, I went back to school and then eventually got my master's in interior architecture. And I will say a lot of people thought I was crazy. A lot of people thought I was courageous. But one thing I learned from that is no experience is wasted. And my previous career and my education have 100% informed what kind of designer I am. So I would not have the philosophy I have. If I had any other path, I would not have my design philosophy. I would not have the way I run my business without those many years working with CFOs and COOs in project management. So I know designers come from all walks of life, and I think we all feel similarly that everything we did in our past life really informs who we are as a designer.
That's one of my favorite parts about doing this podcast, is having this conversation at the beginning and hearing, and even when I meet new designers, hearing what they did before.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always so random, but it always comes full circle. Rather, you have a legal background or accounting background, or they were doctors or whatever they were in a previous career, that all kind of pays forward into the new career. It all trickles down in some way. And sometimes they don't even realize it until we begin to have this conversation.
Yes.
But I think it's so valuable, because I don't think anyone should ever limit themselves and say, you know what, I went to school for this and this is who I am. It's like, no, you be whoever you need to be and let your past influence and inform that path.
Yes, yes.
Let's talk about your approach to design. Biophilic.
Yes.
Let's talk about that for a second. That's a big word. That's like a Scrabble word to me.
Yes.
And I didn't know much about it, but now I have an understanding of it because of our prior conversations. And I'm excited to talk about it, because there's so much of that that trickles down into everything that we do on a design level that I never realized. And I bet a lot of the listeners out there haven't realized either. So share with us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So the concept of biophilia is not a new concept, but it's the idea that as human beings, we have an innate connection to nature. And in regards to biophilic design, it's having that understanding that we have this connection to nature that's very important, and that we have moved from agrarian nomadic societies very quickly into the built environment. Mm-hmm. And so we used to have all of the beauty of nature around us. All of our bodily systems are attuned to the natural environment. So when you go into the building, you lose all of that. So biophilic design is how do, there's like 14 different approaches of how to bring that into the built environment. So mm-hmm. most obviously and straightforward is bringing in nature. So having plants around you, having living things in your space.
Right.
Another really obvious one that people don't even think that they do is using natural materials, using marble, using quartzite, using wood floors. Yeah. It's not a mistake that we're using these materials. We're using them because we feel connected to them. It's why we've used them from the beginning until now.
Right.
You know, we're not putting plastic. Well, you know, most people are not putting plastic on their floors because we don't relate to plastic in the same way that we do to wood.
Yeah. We actually avoid it.
Yeah. And so they can be, like I said, as obvious as visual connections to nature, and they can be as kind of abstracted as risk and peril. So mm-hmm. if you're designing a building and you're doing a balcony that kind of juts off into it, so it gives you this expansive view, but kind of a sense of danger too. So there's a lot of ways you can interpret it. And I think like the larger your project, the more you can bring in all of these different layers.
Right.
But at the minimum, I think most designers are doing this on intuition because it's so innate to us. It's an innate connection. So we're bringing it when we're creating our spaces, mm-hmm. right? We're given nature. That's been given to us. We just born into it. But we're creating our spaces, and we're trying to recreate what's in nature in our built environment without even knowing it.
It's kind of like we've always wondered what that point of reference is, and it's like a mystery, but it's not.
Yeah.
It's just our natural surroundings. Like you said, it's innate, and that's just naturally inspiring to us.
Yeah, I think so. And most of the design firms who, like bigger design firms or larger vendors, they know this, and they mm-hmm. design with these principles. So Apple's campus, Google's campus, they've employed all of these things because they understand that if they want to get the most from their employees, the most creativity, the most productivity, they have to create environments that are going to promote those things.
Right.
And biophilic design is one way to do that, and a powerful one.
Because even in the most modern environments or architectural environments, there's always those elements of nature. So
yes.
Even if it's all steel and glass, what's beyond that glass actually becomes a part of the space and kind mm-hmm. of checks that box and creates maybe this balance for us.
Absolutely.
I've been thinking a lot about how it makes me feel.
Yes.
You know, you use such an interesting example, and I might be skipping ahead, but the simplest example that you use for me that made me go, oh yeah, is when you said it's like, you know, when you walk into like how a space makes you feel. And I thought, well, what do you mean how a space makes you feel? It's like, well, when you walk into church, it makes you feel a certain way, and it actually prompts your behavior.
Yes.
Is what you said, which I thought
yes.
was really interesting. And I may be jumping ahead.
Well, no, I think that is very in line with what we're talking about, is it prompts your behavior. And that's where I wish more designers kind of claimed that, how powerful what we're doing is.
Yeah.
This is not about fluffing pillows and picking out. I mean, it's that too. Don't mm-hmm. get me wrong. But there's a huge power that we have behind what we do and a value in that. And it's really important that we start to recognize that ourselves, because it's very easy to stay at that superficial level and think that's all your worth is. But we create environments. We're telling people how to behave in space. That's right. That is powerful. To me, that's the funnest part of the job.
Yeah, but I've never thought of it that way, though. And I think I'm glad we're having this conversation, because as design professionals, especially business owners, we're constantly thinking of new and innovative ways to market ourselves and demonstrate value to our clients mm-hmm. and demonstrate to them what we're doing and how it affects them personally. Like, it's about more than just resale value. You know what
yes,
I mean?
Absolutely. Yeah. I remember when I was in school at UCLA, one of our professors said, you know, we are a professional service, like charging. He was very against being like a salesperson. And I know we mm-hmm. get a huge revenue and profit margin from selling things, but it's also important that we think of ourselves that way, that we're not just selling product, we're selling an experience.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that experience that people have, that's the gift of design. It's what experience do you want people to have when they come into your home or to your office? And I love the example of the church. It's not mine. It's actually from a documentary. something like architecture. Martha Stewart is the voiceover. It's really fascinating. And they said that. They're like, no one tells you how to behave in a church, but you walk in and you know that you're going to be reverent.
Right.
It's all communicated with, you know, the architecture, the materials, the layout of, you know, the furniture that's in the space. It tells you.
Right.
So
it's so interesting. It is so interesting. So one of the questions that I had for you and that I want to expand upon on the podcast, because I thought it opened up a really great dialogue, was the difference between biophilic design and feng shui. And I was like, is this a new feng shui? Like, help me understand this. And so what is your take on that? Like, help us understand the difference, and maybe one inspires the other at some level, but it's not the same.
They're not the same at all. On some layer, of course, there's probably a little overlap, but feng shui is the ancient art of kind of harmony between man and place. And feng shui is expressed in many different ways. And there's a lot of, not controversy, but there's two different main schools of feng shui. There's the compass method, which is all based on location. And then there's the other one, which is kind of more on a trigram. So without getting into the details of it, feng shui is very commonly misunderstood. But feng shui, my take on feng shui is it's neurobiology and quantum physics. And the ancient Chinese people just knew what was up. They were more intuitive than us. And a lot of science proves their concepts.
Yeah.
So it's all, it's how the body interacts with space. It is, but it's not just based on nature. It's actually a lot of it could have no nature element to it. So I don't know if that answers your question. So yes, there's an overlap, but they're distinct, because biophilic design is more about our connection to nature. And I would say feng shui is more our connection to place.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I get that.
With a lot of elaborate ways of thinking about it.
Right. I just feel like the biophilic design concept is a little easier. It was easier for me to embrace. And I'll be honest with you, like, I was never a fan of feng shui. I never dug into it and fully understood it, and I just wrote it off as this trendy kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that probably was not smart of me. You know, as a design professional, I should have at least understood it before I judged it. And then, you know, it is what it is. But it just never seemed to land with me. But this connection to nature does land with me. I can think of far more examples in just my day-to-day creative process that align with this concept. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. And I think with feng shui, so I had to take a feng shui class as an elective. I didn't want to take it, but I was about to graduate and I needed 2 credits and it was available to me. And I was like, oh, I don't really want to take this class. But by the end of the class, it totally changed my perspective on space planning. And I think that's where, so one of my principles of design is what I call intuitive feng shui. So where I'm really using it for space planning and furniture placement.
Okay.
And so part of feng shui is, like, you know, you have to use certain colors and there's certain symbols, and it's very abstract and it kind of is really hard to understand.
Yeah.
But the way that I use it is, so we have a primitive brain, we all have it, that's trying to keep us safe all the time. And it's kind of like, you know, your heart beating and your lungs, your breath, right? We don't think about it, it's just happening all the time. So we have that in our brain. And our brain is wired to keep us safe. So with feng shui, like, for example, where I'm sitting, I know the audience can't see us, my back is to a glass wall. So I'm in, like, the worst position because I can't see what's coming my way.
Right.
That means my body and my nervous system is not going to be as restful as yours is, where your back is to the wall and you can see everything coming my way.
Your back is to a glass wall and to a door.
Yeah, and to, like, a hallway where people are passing by. Yeah. So that means...
And I did that on purpose because I'm more comfortable being able to see who's walking around and who's going to come through that door.
Exactly. And that's why I call it intuitive feng shui, because you intuitively know that, usually, especially designers, when you go to a restaurant, I always pick what's called the power position. Something solid to your wall. You can see what's coming.
Yeah.
Most designers are going to... I think designers are more conscious of these things, but everyone feels them. So as a designer, I may know, as you did, that you're going to sit there. And a layperson may not. But what they aren't realizing is that their body's not as restful as it could be.
It's like picking the side of the bed.
Yes.
Oh, because, I mean, even when I go out of town, I still sleep on the same side of the bed in the hotel that I would sleep at home.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it just doesn't seem right.
Exactly. And so designers typically will also know where to place a bed in a bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a bunch of designers come into a room, they're probably all going to say, put it on that wall. And even a client intuitively knows because, again, there's the safest wall in the room. The
right.
room that has hopefully something solid or a window high above the bed,
mm-hmm.
a view to the door, but not in line with the door. So these are things that we're already doing. And I think it's really important to know it so you can explain it to your client.
Completely.
You know, I'm putting your bed here because this is where you're going to have the best sleep. And sleep is critical to you.
Right.
So I use it for the space planning in that way.
We're taking a quick break to recognize another one of our partners who helps keep the information and inspiration coming week after week. This podcast episode is sponsored by Design Manager, the design trade's most reliable project management, purchasing, and accounting platform. The business of design is complex and requires solutions developed specifically for our industry. Design Manager has invested decades responding to the needs of interior design professionals and continues to deliver innovative tools to manage your design business with efficiency and profitability in mind. Visit designmanager.com to start a free 30-day trial of the tool trusted by top interior design firms across the country.
And the other part is the quantum physics, which is that everything has an energy to it, right? So the energy of an antique chair is different than the energy of a super modern chair. So it's how do you create harmony in the space by balancing all those different energies? So an example is if you've ever gone to a museum and got into a period room where everything is antique, like all of it, you usually don't feel that great in it.
It's too much.
Yeah, it's too much.
Yeah.
The energy kind of feels old and stale. But if you go into a house that has pieces from now, pieces from the past, you'll probably feel really good because the pieces from the past are kind of ground you.
Yep.
And then the other pieces are going to give you fresh energy.
Yeah. And even in a space that's just, you know, let's just say it's very contemporary and there's that one odd piece,
mm-hmm.
a vintage piece or something like that, which I always gravitate to,
mm-hmm.
because it's just, you're right, it's giving off a vibe.
Yeah, exactly. And something I also learned from that documentary is that interior design is not as subjective as we think it is,
mm-hmm.
meaning that if you had a bunch of people judging artwork, you're going to get responses all over the board.
Oh, yeah.
But if you have people judging interiors, I may say, I'm not very contemporary, but if I go into a well-designed contemporary space, I'm going to say that was well done. Or if I'm not mid-century modern and I go into a mid-century modern, it may not be my style, but if it's well designed, most people are still going to gravitate and like it.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's actually less variation of subjectiveness to interior design than we think. And I think it has to do with all these things that we're talking about.
And going back to what I had said earlier, and we talked about this before, is that designers are constantly looking for ways to communicate and demonstrate to their clients, you know, their value.
Yes.
And you don't have to give them the whole quantum physics lesson. You don't have to give them the whole background of biophilic or feng shui. Just knowing and understanding how it impacts your decisions and design, and then just translating that in whatever manner you want is telling the client, wow, like you get it.
Yeah.
You know, exactly. You're not just telling me this is going to go here, but you're kind of telling me why. And whether I buy it or not, the fact that you have a reason or an intention, I'm on board.
Right. And I think the other thing is some of my clients could care less. They actually don't care about this, but they're going to feel the effects of it. So
yes.
They'll feel the outcome of the decision is still experienced by them, even if they don't understand it. So we always like to say we create beautiful interiors that will also you'll feel really good in, because there's
right.
a lot of interiors that are beautiful, but you don't necessarily feel good. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, maybe you don't know why, but you just don't feel good in it.
Right. And so whether they're questioning your intentions or not, they're going to experience it one way
exactly.
or another. It's going to come back to you.
Totally.
And that's clearly for every designer. It's our favorite moment is when a client calls and just says, gosh, I just walked into my house and I love it so much. And I
yeah.
just wanted you to know that, or I'm
yes.
so glad to be home, even though I was on an amazing vacation in Europe, it's still so great to be home. It
mm-hmm.
feels like home, you know,
totally.
And you know, in your mind why it feels that way.
Yes.
And just let them enjoy it.
Yeah, exactly.
we were supposed to be more organized, and it's my fault, and talk about, you know, the key areas that drive your design. We've covered most of them, but one of them is ritualizing routine.
Yes.
Explain that to me a little bit more, because...
Yeah. So that's... So when we're designing, and especially with interior architecture, where you're actually really creating the space, so we're not just picking finishes and doing a facelift, but we're actually shaping the space. And like you alluded to in the beginning of the podcast, we're very busy today. Like, we have never had so many modern conveniences, but yet we have no time.
Mm-hmm.
We have no time. So the idea of ritualizing routine kind of came from working with clients and realizing that we needed to use the architecture or the furniture placement to get people to pause for a moment.
Yeah.
So they're still doing the same things, right? You're cooking, but how are we going to use the space to kind of elevate what you're doing in it? So for example, a very simple example, I'm working right now with a client who owns a restaurant. And he cooks a lot. He cooks all of his meals from scratch every single day, doesn't eat leftovers. So when we're doing his kitchen, we're creating an island with seating that is more like a table that has a cooktop in the island. So it's just little things like that, because now instead of his back being faced to his whole family while he's cooking, now he's able to engage with them. So it's a way really to promote connection in your space, either to others or to yourself. Like, let's say you want a meditation practice. Well, we're going to design a space in your house that's going to, you know, encourage you to do that, to take time for yourself to enjoy the present moment rather than rushing through, you know. Or maybe you don't want an island in your kitchen because you want to connect with your family. And if you have that island there, you know everyone's going to eat their meals super quickly, run out the door. So you eliminate island seating and you do a dining table next to your kitchen, you're going to encourage that. So that's kind of what we think about. So our practice is really about promoting well-being for our clients. And that's not just physical, but it's also the emotional part. So being connected, if you have a family, to your family is going to be important to you.
Yeah, those are such good examples, because like you said, for the chef or for someone who cooks all day and enjoys doing that for his family, you know, that is a certain sort of ritual or behavior that's a value to the family. And so you would design differently than for the other family who you said may run out the door after eating really quickly. So guess what? We're having a dining room. I know no one does those anymore, but we're sitting down at the table every night and we're going to dine together. Therefore, we actually are one of those families that needs a dining room. That's so interesting.
Yes. Yeah. So again, I don't think anything I'm saying, it's not new or novel.
No.
We're all doing this. So in that whole kind of crisis I was having of whether this is valuable or not, I had to think of what was important to me and why this is important. So my principles really distilled that down to the four things, which we've talked about three now. And because knowing why you're doing something, the why behind it, is just so important.
Oh my gosh, I
think a lot of designers, they're already doing this. So it's kind of like recognizing the amazing work you're doing.
Right, right. And to your point, when we started the conversation, it really is about, I mean, no judgment, but am I going to just do a design that's pretty?
Yeah.
And make you happy and stay within budget? Or am I going to create a design that's really going to impact the way you live?
Yeah.
And make you feel really amazing?
Yes.
That's the difference.
Yeah. And I don't see why... I think it can all be that on any budget too.
Completely.
So these are not just concepts that are for people who have huge budgets. I've worked with people who had like no budget, and we were in the beginning of my career, especially, we were sourcing from Target and IKEA. These things are still achievable. So it's about having the eye for it, which, you know, if you're a good designer, you probably have a good eye. You're probably more attuned on these principles than the rest of society, which is why people are paying you to do it for them.
And I will tell you, I'm big on my alone time, and I love my space, and I'm very particular about my space. My husband and I talk about this all the time too, because he's like, do you think people would think that our house is cool, or is it really just for us? He's like, honestly, you know, a lot of designers, like, what do you think so-and-so would say if he or she came? And I'm like, I'm really not sure. All I know is that it's right for us.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that table works for us. We have a dining table that seats four, but most of it is just piled with books and magazines and plants and candles, and we eat at the two open spaces.
Yeah.
And then, you know, our living room only has two chairs in it because there's just two of us, and I don't entertain.
Yeah.
So I'm just surrounded by books and two comfortable chairs, and my dog bed is in the middle of the room, and that's just, it feels You know, those are the moments.
Yes.
These rituals, if you will,
right,
that are important to us. It's like we have a certain amount of time that we can spend together eating.
Mm-hmm.
We have a certain amount of time that we can spend sitting and reading with the dog. And then the rest of the time we're working and sleeping.
Right. Yeah. No, I love that you did that, because it's a shame when people try to design a house that doesn't relate to them, because that to me is like the saddest thing. I love that if I were to go into your house, I'm immediately going to know who you are. I'm going to know so much about you just by walking in.
Totally.
Everyone should have that experience. Yeah.
You might not have any place to sit, but
I might understand that, you know. You're not going to invite me over a lot, but hey, that's valuable information.
That's not true. We have plenty of seating. So there is one more area that we didn't cover, and that's
beauty.
Beauty. Let's talk about that.
And I always say, like, beauty is the main reason why we have a job.
Right.
People want beauty. And I think this was the one I struggled with the most. Like, is it, you know, beauty? Is it, you know, how deep is beauty? How important is, I mean, I really did ask myself, does it actually matter if you have a beautiful home? So I contemplated this one. I've actually researched it quite a bit to see what are other people saying about beauty. And what I found is that beauty is incredibly important. So it's why people typically hire us. But I like to think in terms of nature, because everyone can relate to that. But if you've ever been around, I don't know, a vista of some sort, or the ocean, or anything that really struck you as beautiful, you kind of lose a sense of yourself. It's like no longer, this is how I describe it anyways, no longer are you separate from it all.
Mm-hmm.
You lose your edges. You lose the boundaries of who you are, and you kind of unite with that thing that feels bigger than yourself.
That's exactly what I was just thinking. It's bigger than you.
It's bigger than, and it's so hopeful. Mm-hmm. It kind of inspires a feeling of hope when you encounter something beautiful. You're like, it just makes you feel good. Like there's something good in the world. There's something good about this space.
Right.
And to me, that's one of the most important feelings that we have. And actually, in regard to biophilic design, they were studying areas that had no greenery. So kind of like the concrete jungles and very poor economic areas that, you know, the developers just put a bunch of like huge buildings together. I think the example was in New York, and it was just concrete buildings, no green spaces. And they said the people are doubly impoverished because they're impoverished, you know, economically,
mm-hmm.
but they're also impoverished from beauty. They have no beauty around them. And so it's no surprise when people like that in those conditions don't thrive, because
right.
we need to have that hopeful feeling. So that to me is what beauty is on a very kind of abstract level.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I think every designer tries to accomplish for their clients.
Right.
And I think, you know, pretty and beautiful are different. Pretty to me is you haven't taken all these next steps. You've stayed on the surface of, I'm going to pick a sofa that's this color. Like, you know, I'm going to pick this without going into the deeper part. I think when you hit that deeper level, that's when you get into beauty.
And beauty and expensive are also two very different things as well.
Yeah. Oftentimes, beauty can be expensive.
Yes, it can. Yes, it can. But it's not a requirement.
It's not a requirement.
Yeah.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
Mm-mm.
We were just talking about vintage before we hit record, and that's why I thought about that. Because
mm-hmm.
you were, for the listeners, she was kind of quizzing me about what I liked about a certain space. Well, I think actually I was quizzing myself as I was telling you what I liked about the space and mm-hmm. why that space appealed to me compared to the other amazing spaces, which were also beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the expensive component was distracting to me, whereas the natural beauty of this organic space, it just appealed to me more.
Yeah.
And so it's different.
It is different.
It's different.
They're not the same.
But they're successfully designed at the same level. Beautiful design.
Mm-hmm.
Go figure.
Yeah.
So now, with all of this being said, tell me how this approach has impacted the way that you do business. I mean, just from speaking with you for the last 15 minutes, my head is kind of spinning with different ways that you can market yourself and just the different ways that you interact with your clients. You tell me, how has it impacted the way that you do business and how you, you know, work with your clients?
Yeah. Well, I definitely spend a lot of time on my website, and I know not everyone has the attention span to read through everything on there, but there's little snippets into my philosophy on my website. Mm-hmm. So I think right away, people who are thoughtful and or high performing are going to be more attracted to me because they're going to see that I'm a thoughtful designer, that I've really thought deeply about these things. And if you're high performing, you're going to really care about your well-being. So all of that is kind of sprinkled in my website. And I think that helps me attract my ideal client. So someone who maybe doesn't care about those things might skip on to someone else.
Right.
So I think it's all in my marketing. It's also how I speak to my clients. I think one of the main things is it allows me to help them make decisions. So I don't really feel like I have to convince my clients to do what I think is best. I educate them to make the best choice for themselves. And so it definitely impacts my communication. Mm-hmm. And in terms of, you know, project management, you know, it doesn't affect those things. It's more of like the front side of the business, like my marketing message and how I get clients to make decisions.
Right, right. Because I just feel like by having this underlying knowledge or strategy, or I don't know what you would call it, but it just would make for a much more effective communication with the clients. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Because a lot of times I ask questions and it's like, oh my gosh, you feel like you have to have an answer for everything.
Right.
And there really kind of is, but they're not all like textbook answer. A lot of it is emotion based. Yes. A lot of there's so many things that contribute to a response.
Mm-hmm. And I really dislike when a client asks me a question and I can't explain it. Because I should be, in a way, what you're saying is very accurate, that we have a very emotional response to space. Or like if they say, well, what do you think about this fabric? A lot of times you'll know, right? No, that is a no. But if you can explain why, your answer has less power to them.
Completely. You have to be able to articulate your decision.
So I usually will have an answer. Right. So I hate when I get stumped because sometimes I'm like, you know what? I don't know why. And I'll have to really think about it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's okay to just say, you know what? That I'm just not feeling that fabric. And that's okay.
Yeah. I'll just say, intuitively, I'm not feeling that one.
And I'll buy that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I'll buy that over I don't know.
Exactly.
All day long. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, no, I think that's great. I think that, you know, when we originally started talking about this and I was trying to make a connection between the design philosophy and the actual business of design, and the more that we talked, the more I realized, gosh, there's a lot of nuggets of information here and just little tips and strategies on how to just better communicate. Mm-hmm. And just kind of dig into your design process as a designer, as yes. you're doing it, and begin to ask yourself, why did I make that decision? How does that mm-hmm. make me feel? How do I think it's going to make my client feel? If I don't know how it's going to make them feel, maybe I need to ask them more questions.
Right. Yes.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Sometimes I think of clients, you know, there's different aesthetics. So like, for example, with biophilic design, that doesn't mean you see one look all the time. And I tell my clients, it's what I do is an approach and a philosophy, but that doesn't mean you're going to get a look. It's not going to be like, oh, that is a biophilic look. Mm-hmm. So if you think of like the desert and you think of a rainforest, they're both natural environments, but they have different vibes. So you might have a client who's more monochromatic and they're kind of like deserty.
Sure.
And you might have someone who's more exuberant with more color and texture. They're more like a rainforest.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. I think as a consumer, I would rather hear a designer say, I'm not going to give you a contemporary look. I'm not going to put you in a box. I'm not going to give you a farmhouse look. I'm just going to give you a design that makes you feel good.
Yeah.
And that's representative of you and that you're going to enjoy mm-hmm. living in. And I would kind of go down this list of things, you know, that are important to me as a designer and that should hopefully be important to the client and how mm-hmm. they live.
Right.
And like you said, if there's not an alignment, then maybe that's not a fit.
Yeah, exactly. I think I work best with thoughtful people mm-hmm. just because I tend to be more thoughtful about the things I do. So I don't typically work with people who want to stay at the level of pretty.
Right.
They'll pretty quickly will kind of get on that same page. Even not that everybody knows about it,
yeah.
but usually once like I'll just connect more with that clientele.
So I'm hoping that the big takeaway from this conversation for designers is that begin to ask themselves, you know, more questions and really kind of inform their clients what mm-hmm. informs their decision making mm-hmm. and ask themselves a question that you asked yourself in the beginning, Like, is this really having the impact that I want it to have mm-hmm. on my clients? And if it's not, you know, begin to employ some of these, you know, yes. tactics, for lack of a better word, which we all seem to be doing already.
Yeah, they're strategies.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, if you're a designer, at the very minimum, learn about biophilic design, because yeah. You can't escape it. It's like in our bodies.
Right.
And there's a lot of research that has been done on biophilic design, like Johns Hopkins. Major institutions are actually researching how our brain responds to space. Mm-hmm. So I would say, like, that's something that we should, if you're a designer, you should be interested in.
I was just thinking, like, we as designers, we're going to learn more about ourselves yes. just by investing time and learning yes. about it. You know, it's going to probably answer so many questions.
I think so.
We're like, why did I pick that? Yeah. How did I know that?
Yes.
How did I know that's right?
Right.
We've got some signature questions here at the podcast. Yes. So we're going to dive into those next.
Okay.
Starting with your secret to survival. So what would you say is your secret to survival in this business of design?
Well, I would say it's very hard to survive sometimes, especially with how busy we are, or most of us are right now. I have found being organized. Being 10 times more organized than you even think you need to be organized is kind of the name of the game. Because I worked with Celery Kemble, who's a really big designer in New York. And she told me design is 10% creative, 90% project management. And that was wisdom that I never forgot. And it realized very quickly once I started working.
Yeah.
So you come up with the vision, that's the creative part. The rest of it is managing a million moving pieces and things going wrong, and being very organized is really the key to survival for me. I feel like, honestly, I'm never organized enough, because there's just, you know, I try to document every meeting, every decision, mm-hmm. you know, because especially our projects can be a year plus.
Oh, yeah.
You'll forget like what you talked about on that day. So having like meeting minutes or a summary of notes and decisions, little things like that, to stay organized and also to cover yourself, you know, when things go wrong, you can say, well, we discussed that on this date. I have it yeah. documented. That really helps. So staying on top of the project management.
Yeah, that documentation is key, because you're right. You're not going to remember that 16 months or 18 months down the line. And you don't want to spend that 18 months hoping that you don't have to recall that and trying yes. to retain it. Just write it down.
Right. And clients expect you to remember it all.
Absolutely.
You know, they're paying you a good amount of money. And even if it's unreasonable to expect you to remember every single thing, they will trust you so much more if you have detailed notes. So yeah. I've had clients tell me, I loved how organized you were, because a lot of times with interior design, we're really good at the creative part. And I don't have to tell you this, because your whole business model is this, right? Either we're really good at the creative part, but we can't run a project well. And at the end of the day, if you can't run, you can be okay at design, but be great at project management, and your clients are probably going to have a better experience than the creative who has all these great ideas, but they can't get it together.
Yeah. Yeah, the execution is yeah. everything.
Yes.
And what would you say is the one thing you know now that you wish you knew then, when you started in the business of design?
How much you're going to have to learn on the job. So I went to, like, yeah, the highest level. I don't have a PhD, but I have a master's in interior architecture. And I came out, and when I started my business, I knew nothing. So realizing that even though I took business strategies and project management in school, it did not prepare me for getting out into the real world.
Yeah.
And realizing how much of my education was going to take years of experience to get.
There's just some things you cannot learn in a classroom.
Yeah. Yep.
You've got to be out there in the trenches.
Yes. Yes.
And how would you say that you pay it forward in the design community?
For me, I recently hired two design assistants. And even before I had design assistants, when I worked for a firm, we had interns. I always really take the time to explain things, because I know how hard it is to be a beginner at something and to feel like there's a lot of expectations put on you, but you may not know it all. So I spend a lot of time mentoring, whether it was interns or now the design assistants who work with me. First of all, I enjoy it. I love being able to teach people things that I've learned. It's like giving a gift.
Right.
So I would say that's my biggest way.
Yeah. Helping them learn what you didn't know when you when you started, when you walked off campus and onto a job site.
Right. I'll say this may be really boring, but this is really important. Like, you need to learn how to do a spreadsheet. You need to learn how to do these things.
Yeah.
And it may not be your favorite thing to do, but I'm going to give you this experience because you'll know that you should know that it's going to make you a stronger designer.
Yeah. You can learn this now, or you can learn this in 2 years or 3 years when you're pulling your hair out.
Right. Yes.
But eventually you are going to learn this, so let me help you.
Yes.
That's awesome. Well, listen, I really appreciate you taking the time to come on the podcast and share this information with us. How can the listeners find you, your website, so that they can read more about it and learn more about you? Your website is really great. I mean, that's kind of what prompted me to develop this outline, which I completely ignored, and I usually do that, so whatever. But I had a really good outline dialed in, but I had learned a lot after we spoke, just by reading your website. And so I think that other designers could as well. So how do we find that?
So that's catchdc.com, and that's short for Catch Design Collective. I did not want to do a very long, so I abbreviated the D and the C. So, and then my Instagram is Catch Design Collective with the little underscore in between each word, which I heard is very outdated now. So I'm like, maybe I need to, because you can't do spaces.
Yeah.
So I have the underscore.
It is what it is. We'll find you. Because it's Catch with a K.
Yes, it's Catch with a K. I always tell people that. Catch
so it
with
comes
K.
right up.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Julie.
Thank you
I appreciate
so much.
It.
This was so much fun.
So I have a confession to make. When Julie approached me about featuring biophilic design on the podcast, I was on the fence. This is a podcast about the business of design, but when I explored her website and discussed the concept with her further, I couldn't wait to schedule the interview. I always wondered where this creative design intuition stemmed from. Like Julie said in the interview, the concept of biophilic design is neither new or groundbreaking. It's something that we as design professionals have been practicing for as long as we can remember. But many of us never knew that our eye for design had a name. Perhaps more of you are familiar with biophilic design than I may think. But now, we're also aware of the impact it can have on your business of design. As design professionals, we are constantly asked why. The answers usually come from a place of vision and passion. Now we can put some science behind it. Expressing what influences your design decisions increases your value and reinforces the trust between you and your clients. I challenge you to explore the principles of biophilic design and allow them to help you level up your design approach, your marketing vocabulary, and how you communicate with your clients. Thanks, Julie, for sharing your valuable insight on this intriguing topic. Do you want advance notice of all things Design Biz Survival Guide? Go to our website and join our email list for announcements of upcoming programs and events. Already signed up but not receiving your weekly updates? Check your spam or junk filter, because we have some very exciting announcements coming soon that you do not want to miss. Thanks for joining us, everyone. And until next time, be safe, be kind, and get out there and inspire.